It's time for action, gentlemen.
Once again, we've saved civilization as we know it.
Yeah, the good news is they're not going to prosecute.
I give. She takes. She won't permit me my life. I've got to live hers.
Jim.
I have a beautiful yeoman. Have you noticed her, Mr. Spock? You're allowed to notice her. The captain's not permitted.
Scan the starship Excalibur, which you destroyed. Is there life aboard?
No life.
Because you murdered it.
What's the matter, Jim? Don't you trust yourself?
I've already got a female to worry about. Her name's the Enterprise.
Didn't quite get that, Mrs. Scott.
Nothing, sir.
Repeat it.
I was suggesting that Mr. Spock could probably translate it for you, sir.
I assume you're complimenting Mr. Spock on his ability to decode.
I'm not sure, sir.
Well, here's one thing you can be sure of, Mr. Leave any bigotry in your quarters. There's no room for it on the bridge. Do I make myself clear?
You do, sir.
Never trusted Klingons. And I never will. I can never forgive them for the death of my boy.
Spock says this could be an historic occasion, and I'd like to believe him. How on earth can history get past people like me?
Now, Whom Pods Destroy.
Welcome back to another edition of Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I am Terry, and I am joined, as ever, by Derek.
Hello!
And by Graham.
Hello!
Wonderful stuff. It's good to be back. Last episode, we were talking about The Enemy Within, and it's such a heavy Kirk episode that we thought that this would be a good jumping-off point to have a general conversation about Captain James Tiberius Kirk. Before we get into the character itself, let's talk a little bit about a film that Graham and Derek, you are both familiar with, that probably actually landed William Shatner with the role of Captain Kirk. Obviously, everyone tends to think of Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, that Twilight Zone episode, written by Richard Matheson, the writer of The Enemy Within, and how that maybe was probably his most famous role up to that point. But in fact, it is said that he got the role of Kirk on the basis of his part in a film called The Intruder. Would you care to talk about that?
It was a 1962 Roger Corman film, low budget, set in the Deep South in the time of educational integration, and it's a very, very powerful film. In the film, he plays a white supremacist from the North who moves down to the South to basically cause trouble and to move into a community and basically to stir up racist beliefs and trouble, really. And he does that very, very well. He plays a very sort of charismatic character, young man in a white suit, just gets off the bus and just starts causing trouble. And it's a fantastic role, and he plays it really well. Really difficult to watch to these days. Because it is so honest, it's so raw. The language they use in it is pretty rife. The N-word appears pretty much from the opening scenes and goes throughout it, and it's used in the worst possible way throughout. But he is brilliant in it. He's calculating. He's horrible, a horrible character. But and interesting that we've just come back from discussing The Enemy Within with an evil version of Kirk. This is an evil version of Kirk. You can see him as someone who is influential, who is charismatic, and who can manipulate people and lead them.
He comes across as a very intelligent person, and obviously the whole thing, charismatic. The film, The Intruder, is, as you said, it's very prescient now, actually, I think.
Yes, certainly.
In our troubled times, you know, and you could say that sort of like, you know, the devil in the white suit is what I sort of saw. It was very much like a devil comes to town sort of thing. Really sort of, you know, pulls out bits out of people's character and then uses it.
There is something sort of not unhuman about him, where because every time you meet someone else, he offers his hand and said, "I do hope we can be friends."
Yeah.
And there is something sinister. There is something you're offering a lot more than just your hand.
That's very much the devil sort of thing.
Yeah, it is.
It's written by, who's the writer in this?
Beaumont.
Charles Beaumont.
Who was a Twilight Zone.
Yeah. It's interesting because he's a writer of science fiction and horror, Charles Beaumont, or mostly horror.
Yeah.
But this movie is not a horror film. Is there an element of supernatural about the movie?
It's human horror, though. Right, that's what it is. It is. Yeah, you don't need the supernatural element on this.
But it's a political film, if you like. It's a film with a political message.
That sort of metaphysical feel about
it.
That it is an evil that is descending on a town.
Yeah.
Rather than something that is man made. And I suppose that's what we look at nowadays. We all sort of think this sort of makes you contemplate the idea of evil when you see things sort of just blossoming and normal rational people coming up with ideas that are really quite awful.
Well, these are the ideas that are already there. I mean, this is 1962 the film was released, and I think that it was written the end of the 1950s. And remember, again, that period of time, since a lot of the people who were in this actually experienced World War II, obviously with the rise of fascism and sort of like the Holocaust and everything like that. So the idea that you have, you know, people can be, you know, pushed a certain way. You know, it is an allegory for, like, you know, a charismatic person pushing people with their own prejudices and stuff like that, and just giving them a release.
Yeah.
So, in many ways, that's more frightening than some kind of supernatural creature manifesting itself as a man and visiting chaos and discord, you know, on a community,
but
that actually is just actually a human being.
Yeah. When I watched it, I was thinking, so I'm Gene Roddenberry, sat down watching a screening of this. Mm. What is making me jump? What is making this guy jump out to me and say, "That's my Kirk. That's my captain. That's the guy who's going to lead this spaceship of discovery and." This very
there's a colossal irony going on there. I mean, the Star Trek is intended to be a beacon for liberalism and for humanism.
Yeah,
and yet he draws from a character who's playing the absolute antithesis of that vision.
Yeah.
And takes him in there.
Well, you remember the sort of thing is drama. You know, the arts at the time were basically looking at the questions of the time and sort of like, you know, like Star Trek's perfect. It's an anthology series, and it does look at different facets to humanity, you know, and how we, you know, the different parts of it, and we look at it through alien eyes, or we look for a certain sort of like dramas that happen and stuff like that. So a lot of writers at this time were obviously in that sort of thing, thinking that they're forging art which will say something about the times that they were living in. And it's a traumatic time. Yeah. Obviously, sort of like,
and science fiction is perfect for
perfect
that.
Perfect for it. Yeah. Yeah.
Because it answers the question of today.
I mean, I haven't seen this movie. I'm going to watch it as a matter of urgency. I mean, I'm just really intrigued that you've got a science fiction writer, and then you've got what turns out to be a genre science fiction actor. And indeed, you know, a horror writer and a horror director, Roger Corman, you know, making actually what appears to be a commentary film.
Yeah.
But it also reflects upon the horrificness of the time that it lends itself well to those kind of storytellers.
But remember, this was a problem with this film. It actually lost money.
I imagine it would have been pretty uncomfortable for distributors to look at, particularly in the southern states. I'd have thought, no one's going to want to watch this movie.
No, Pathé showed it in New York, and that was it.
Right.
They didn't show it anywhere else.
And Corman had to take back the rights to actually show it.
Right.
Never made any money until.
Well, anyway, do seek it out, listeners. It's actually available for free. So, I mean, you can get on that YouTube.
Yes.
But if you're on Amazon Prime subscriber, you might be able to find it there.
I mean, we were talking about William Shatner and his character in it. He's acting chops are there.
Well, this is what Roddenberry is looking at specifically for this. He's thinking, I don't want to hire this guy to be a fascist. I want to hire him because of the clear, you know, there's quite characteristics about his acting
and the way he interacts with people and with other actors, and then that's what really comes across in the film. Once you, if you look at it purely on a technical basis, and you get away from the storyline, which is difficult because it's a really, really traumatic storyline. But when you just look at the way he's interacting with the other actors, there's no other big names in it. But there are faces that you recognise as bit actors from other places,
from other stuff you've seen around.
It's a very low budget Roger Corman film. Mm. You know, this is what you get with those films. If you're a director of a what's going to be an anthology TV show, this guy is on the screen and he's acting with going up against a lot of different types of actors there, and really sort of owning the screen.
Yeah.
Owning the screen and making it believable what he's doing.
If he's leading the film, then obviously, you need those qualities in the showrunner.
That's the thing as well, is because it's believable as well. Mm. And that's probably another thing about it, which helps in a science fiction series. You've got to be able to have that suspension of disbelief.
Yes.
You've got to make it believable for everyone watching it. And that's what he does in this occasion. And so it's something, I would have think that you would be able to say, yeah, okay, this guy, I'm going to put him in a bright yellow shirt and I'm going to put him in a scenery with lots of aliens and you're going to believe it.
I'm just going to rewind with Star Trek history here, because remember, we've already had our first pilots with Geoffrey Hunter. So, you know, now we've, obviously, you've got the second pilot, so Roddenberry comes along and sees, you know, so obviously they're doing a change of direction from the first Star Trek, and they see this thing. I'm just wondering how it fits in.
Geoffrey Hunter was actually a pretty big star,
and
back in the times when big stars, Hollywood film actors, didn't do telly, it was a big leap to get him in there. And maybe they think, when obviously he didn't want to reprise the role when they did the second pilot, and maybe they went, well, we need to get like someone who's got that star quality, those abilities, the technical acting skills of being able to, as you've described it, Graham, to be able to run this show and make it all work. But we need to find someone who's at the beginning of their career, shall we say, you know,
and
it's going to be cheaper. Blunt,
yeah, yeah. You getting know. getting a lead in low budget films and things like that, and also lead in TV shows.
Clearly, an actor who's good enough to be top of the bill for movies, albeit low budget Roger Corman ones. But and of course, Roger Corman makes good movies. Always did make good movies. So he's a good actor in a good movie. And so fine, and he's cheap. So we'll have him. And in he comes. James R. Kirk into Where No Man Has Gone Before. I mean, and he makes, I mean, the Kirk, we understand Kirk as a human and as a character very, very quickly in the first episode, do we not?
Yes, we do. That certainly helps with, because he's got, not only does he have Leonard Nimoy to go against, but he's got Gary Lockwood there as well, who plays the role really well, and it's really a shame.
And another fine actor
that he's only there for one episode. But another fine actor there. It's interesting because while Kirk doesn't really have the development arc that, say, Spock does, where Spock changes a lot through that first half of the first season. When you get Kirk, he's pretty much out of the box, isn't he?
Yeah.
But he is more restrained, more conservative, especially in that where No Man's Gone Before. And you've got Gary Mitchell, Gary Lockwood as Gary Mitchell there, being the more sort of boisterous Kirk-like character, actually, in certain respects. Certainly, if you imagine Chris Pine's interpretation of Kirk, that it's more of Gary Mitchell than Kirk.
Yeah, no, definitely. There's a real difference between, because the genesis of Kirk, I mean, as the show develops, Kirk gets more action. Shall we say? I mean, he's got more bedtime in the third season.
Yeah.
But in the first season, that's not how he's portrayed at all. I mean, Mitchell describes him as a stack of books with legs, doesn't he? I mean, he's a geek.
Yeah.
And I mean, he's obviously risen to the fact that he's got all the social skills and command skills to become a great captain. But he, in the academy, he's a geek. I mean, I think he's essentially thanking Mitchell. He owes Mitchell an awful lot, because Mitchell has probably taught him the social skills that he needs
to become
more than what he currently is, more than the sort of like rather bookish young man that he is portrayed as. Chris Pine's Kirk.
Yeah.
Is not like that at all.
No, not at all.
That's the thing, is Chris Pine's Kirk actually has changed my opinion of Kirk the character, because, you know, as he supersedes you know, all of the Star Treks before, and it did spoil it for me, actually.
Did it really?
Yeah, because the thing is that, as you said, it's sort of like he comes along and he is a kid who's lost his father. The whole character is different.
It didn't spoil it for me, and it didn't, because it was an alternative timeline. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Kirk loses his father, which is probably clearly a defining experience when he is born, and he's raised as a different person. Whereas we have in prime timeline Kirk, presumably, you know, has a far more stable, dare I say, upbringing, and that, and obviously Kirk never went to Tarsus IV in the JJ universe, so didn't have to experience the Holocaust there and the slaughter there, and that he didn't have that to define him. So Kirk had a different trauma to deal with than.
I'm being a bit harsh, but what I'm
you're being extremely harsh. You're a monster.
I'm a monster. Yeah. Maybe I'm evil.
Yeah.
There's only one logical explanation.
There's clearly an imposter in this room.
But funny enough, after, you know, obviously getting used to Chris Pine's action Kirk, you know, sort of like in his more sort of, you know, primal sort of, you know, go-getter, the one who gets told off all the time for doing stuff, I went back to watching proper Kirk or prime Kirk, you know, and I watched the motion picture. And it's, you know, it's not night and day between the two characters.
Yes.
You know, it really is.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like, because especially when it's like the reintroduction of the character Kirk, because you've got Decker in there as well, who's basically, you know, the go-getting Kirk character who's in there, obviously, which comes up later on in Next Generation as Riker, that sort of thing. So actually, Kirk is more closer to Picard.
Yeah.
You know,
in motion picture, yeah.
In motion picture.
Because we're going to be doing an episode about Phase 2 fairly, relatively shortly, actually. But yeah, the setup for the ensemble in Phase 2 was not massively different to how it ends up in Next Gen.
Yeah.
And Kirk is far more, you're kind of withdrawn, spends more time on the bridge rather than down there fighting, because it's taking into account the Kirk is an aged character, Shatner's an aged actor, and they bring in Decker to play the more action role. And this is essentially replicated in Picard and Riker, and we'll talk about that more when we do Phase 2
episode.
That's
sort of like the Kirk we have at the first, you know, as you said, like the nerd Kirk in the first episode.
Absolutely.
So it's come round in a circle.
I mean, why don't we talk a little bit about some of our favourite Kirk moments, maybe? I mean, mine, I don't know about you, but mine tend to be more towards the first season of Kirk, and I think about particular standout. Maybe this is more of a Shatner thing, really. I mean, I Court Martial is an episode that I enjoy greatly, and the Devil. Although the Devil in the Dark is celebrated more perhaps as a Spock thing, I think that this was the episode where Shatner lost his father and was still turned up for work and still went through it. And I thought put in a really nuanced performance. Do you have any particular, you know, episodes of, you know, like the original series that stand out to you, that you enjoy?
It's things like Changeling, Ultimate Computer, those sort of things. You know, when Shatner just comes along and Kirk makes computers blow up just by talking
them. This ability for him to destroy computers by talking to them. I mean, it's a glorious trope that's sadly redundant now, because it's just nobody buys it. Everyone thinks that computers are more intelligent than we are, so therefore. But it's a great trope to demonstrate the superiority of humanity over the machine, and we have to do is have a conversation with the computer, and we'll send them into a tailspin.
It's not just computers, but anything really. I mean, it comes to its probably zenith in Star Trek V when he does it to this
to God.
He fucks with God.
He totally messes with God's mind. Yeah. And like, you know, I mean, he doesn't take a. I mean, he's just like, but of course, he's got it down to a fine art.
Of course,
I know your soul. I've encountered people like you before, entities like you before, and they're all dust.
Yeah.
They're all dust and broken circuits, you will be.
Yeah. I've got whole shelves full of bits of the stuff that's blown up just by me talking at it.
Yeah, exactly, and it works really. Yeah. It doesn't work well at all. No,
but those episodes where he does get a good speech in there and a good sort of like ram home about the fact the qualities of humanity.
The risk. Like
that. Risk is our business.
That's got to be the best thing in the
series. I mean, like, Return to Tomorrow is just a strong episode. We did an episode of Return to Tomorrow, and we admire it greatly. I mean, the character doesn't really, move on that much, does he? There's not much evolution there. I mean, they create more love interest for him in the third season, but I mean, I think he tends to be a little bit hammier in the third season, but I think that's just because, you know, there's a new showrunner and they tend to take in the show in a bit of a different direction this way.
I mean, it's Shatner as well.
He's serving notice as well at that stage as well, and that does start to show. I mean, they are as professional as they are, but you can tell that there's not the energy that there is in the first season.
Yeah, no, the show's on its uppers. Yeah. This is likely to be their last gig, so everything's all like calming.
Yeah, he's handing out CVs, isn't he? Yeah. When he's not on set. So,
I mean, the thing with Kirk is the actual character is that he's nothing without, you talk about what your favourite episodes. I think he's just nothing without McCoy and Spock.
Well, this is what Star Trek II really rammed home about, the fact that he is who he is. I mean, I suppose that's his key episode, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I think 2 and 6. Well, I mean, I think motion picture, he's having a bit of an existential crisis.
Yeah,
in motion picture, in which he regrets having given up the seat and is now bullied himself back onto the Enterprise bridge, and is in conflict with his first officer, and is also in conflict with his medical officer and with himself, because he thinks, you know, people say that, you know, there's a lack of humanity in motion picture, but I mean, it's not. There's the human drama comes from a conflicted Kirk who knows he's out of order taking this gig and may not actually have made the right call, and is being questioned by people closest to him, and his best friend is going through his own crisis and is unable to offer any kind of support whatsoever to a rather fragile Kirk. And these are elements of motion picture I like, and they're carried on to a degree in Wrath of Khan, where he's old and he feels his age. It's on his birthday, and he's now an admiral, and he's now, you know, like, oh. And then, you know, and that whole story. And
surrounded
it's a
by
big
antiques.
Theme, and he's surrounded by antiques, and it's a big theme, and it's much, much more artfully presented than motion picture. It's got to be said. There is more humanity. There's more viscerality to it.
Because it's pared down as well. Yeah. So in a lot of respects.
Well, the thing that interests me is Star Trek VI, where he's confronted with his own bigotry.
Yes.
And his racism. And it's landed him in a Klingon
prison.
And another
duplicate as well.
And another duplicate. That's very true. Yeah, and played more for laughs, than anything. But good spot though.
Yeah.
But he's, I mean, that moment when he's lying in his bunk and he's confronting himself with the fact that he has very much an architect of his situation. He's allowed his bigotry to cloud his judgment, and that man, which someone else has been able to exploit, and now he's in a Klingon prison, and you know, with at the time little hope.
Let them die.
Yeah, I mean, this is like, let's go. I mean, we could take that. I often think about that scene in Star Trek VI when he says to Spock, "Let them die."
Yeah,
and then I think all the way back to Corbomite Maneuver when he's upbraiding Stiles for his bigotry towards the Romulans, and thinking that's some journey that you've gone through. Obviously, he's gone through a lot as a human being and as a character.
Yeah,
and not least of which, his son has been murdered by a Klingon, and so his bigotry is perhaps understandable, but nevertheless, it is there. And I mean, he's become a poorer human being as a consequence of all of this.
Yeah,
until of course he has something of a moment of redemption. And makes a speech at the end in order to demonstrate to anyone what a dick he's been, and how, I mean, I think that that movie's got a bit troublesome at times, but that works well with Kirk, and it's a great arc for Kirk, and for his last appearance, second to last appearance.
His last appearance.
It's a great way for him to go out, you know, on a much more upbeat, very very Star Trek, very positive.
Yeah,
you know, way of literally signing off. What do we think about Generations, though?
I don't give it much time of thought.
Yeah. Really, I don't. I give it about as much time of thought as Star Trek V. Really.
I mean, Star Trek V is. I mean, we should probably. We won't dwell too much on Star Trek V because it's just not a very good film. Yeah. I mean, it's the one that William Shatner directed. But I just, there are some nice character moments in there.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the whole climbing the mountain. William Shatner climbing the mountain. Yeah, I'm sorry. No. I mean, William Shatner as a human being is a very energetic man.
Yes.
And he still rides horses now, and he's like into his 80s. He's a very, very physical man. Mm-hmm. So he probably was very, very attracted by this idea of Kirk still being able to, you know, climb El Capitan, free climb El Capitan.
Yeah, but, I mean, he was approaching 60 when that film came out, wasn't he?
I guess he must have been, in fairness. Yeah, I mean, he's in his 80s now.
He's 80, when was it?
84, 80, when is it?
Mid 86?
Is it?
Yeah, I think.
Okay, yeah, I mean, it's possible. it's possible. I mean, it's just, I mean, it's a good free climb. I mean, it's well shot, but yeah, I mean, then as soon as you sort of like zoom in, and there's Kirk, and you think, I don't know, it's a bit Roger Moore in A View to a Kill, isn't it? I don't believe that you've actually done this. But it's fine because he gets rescued by the absurdity of Spock in his rocket boots. So by that point, you're thinking, what? This is even worse. More stupid.
Yeah. The rocket boots, probably the second worst gadget in that film after the marshmallow dispenser.
The marshmallow dispenser. Well, hang on. Hang on, the marshmallow dispenser, I think, at least has some value. I mean, like, nobody needs rocket boots. I mean, how on earth could you imagine that?
I want rocket boots.
Yeah, but you can't. Come on, I mean, like, your knees and hip, forget it. I'm like,
where are my rocket boots?
I will shock you and say that I quite like Generations. I enjoy Generations as a film. I do think that the ending is entirely unsatisfactory. I think it's a terrible way for a great character to go. I understand correctly, I think that, you know, Ron Moore has sort of like said, we were younger and we were inexperienced. This was our first movie. We could have done this differently. And I think it is a bit of a shame. And if they were able to retcon Kirk's death, I would be quite happy.
Refresh my mind how he dies. So doesn't he get sort of crashed or something?
He falls off a rickety bridge.
Well, his first death is he's sucked out the front of the Enterprise B, isn't it?
Yes. That's not too bad, but we kind of think, well, I'm sure we'll see him again.
Yeah.
He ultimately dies because he falls off a rickety bridge.
Yeah.
In somewhere
just
that
loses.
The only poignant thing about that is that that rock formation looks very similar to Vasquez Rocks, where Kirk had many visits.
He knows that land.
And fought the Gorn. Yeah. You know, I mean, then that's where you think, oh, this is not, you know, this is your land. And it's all a little bit unsatisfactory, to be perfectly honest with you. Although I think Shatner handles the whole scene quite well. I mean, the moment of his death, I think, is quite good, where he says, oh my, and then sort of like goes. You know, and I quite like that aspect of it. But I do like Generations. If we ever do Generations, I will offer a robust defence of Generations. But in many ways, I may be in the minority. There can only be one possible explanation. Okay, let's just talk a little bit about the future. We have had... we've had Kirk played by a different actor.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not out of the question that James Kirk could return to Star Trek, particularly if they decide to go through, if they carry on with the, you know, I don't know where Discovery ends up. I assume it ends up in the 31st century, which is where they're supposed to go.
Mm.
Although I wouldn't be surprised if that doesn't happen. But there's talk about continuing on, like with an Enterprise series with Pike and whatnot. And I wonder whether or not there's room to see Kirk come back in CBS.
I don't think they should, actually.
You don't think they should?
I think it'd be better without Kirk at the moment. Maybe you hear about him, you know, but I'd think that it would be nice not to actually see him, because you've already got that nice group with the new Spock and Pike.
Yeah,
and Number One.
I'd like to see the continuation of the Enterprise under Pike. I'd like to see Pike get a run.
Spock was pretty integral, wasn't he, for Discovery, because of the family connection. So there is a need for him to be in it.
Mm.
But yeah, I think you're right with Kirk. That may not be as much. You may bring in a younger
Or bring his dad.
Or bring
George. Yeah.
I'd think that they should bring George.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think I was half expecting to see a younger Gary Mitchell coming in the last series.
Mm.
And if you do that, as we've talked about earlier with the way of Chris Pine's interpretation of Kirk, how do you introduce Gary Mitchell and Kirk and have two different characters?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I would hope that if they were to, say, do a younger Kirk, that they would go back to that and say, well, this is a bookish Kirk.
Yeah.
Somewhat cowed Kirk. And I would also think that it would be quite nice for them to do a story around Tarsus IV.
Yeah,
which would be Kirk as a child,
yeah.
And maybe telling that kind of story, because I mean that's something that massively informed his character, but has been kind of because of TOS being anthology, it's a big deal for Conscience of the King, and then they never speak of it again.
Yeah.
Whereas if it had been a modern TV series, then that would have been something that would have been regularly referred to throughout the story, because it's a really, really big deal.
Yeah.
And that's a bit of a... I think the opportunity with what Star Trek, with TBS have done with Discovery, is to reopen that timeline, that part of the story of Star Trek, of the timeline. And it would, since they've gone to the trouble of doing it would be nice to just like delve into some stories that were touched on in Star Trek and go deeper with them. And this would be an opportunity I think I'd like to see him back as. Whether or not I'd like to see a Star Trek with Kirk as the captain with a new actor, you know, a continuation like Series 4of Star Trek, then I think I'd rather leave that to fan fiction than to the real thing.
I think that works well there. I mean, especially in the fan environment where it's perhaps more important to be authentic than to actually present new stories in a new way for a new audience.
This is the tragedy of Discovery, I think, is that for a lot of fans is that they will never buy it because for them it doesn't have that authenticity.
Yeah.
For some of them, not for me. I think it's very authentic, but I mean that's just simply my opinion. Whereas I think that I think Roddenberry actually had the right idea with Next Generation, saying, "No, we're going to move this 100 years late, next into the next century, and we're going to completely refresh the aesthetic and move it away from all of this, because we don't want to have like angry Trekkies telling us we're doing stuff wrong."
Yeah.
So like, and you know, and they still did, but you know, in a way that I think that they could control. Yeah.
And if we go back to stories from the original series, then it's just going to be, well, it's going to be old news. It's going to be things that have happened.
And we know what happened. So I mean, because we know what happens to those characters.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's the thing. Just drifting off slightly, the thing that worries me about maybe doing a Pike series is that ultimately we know what happens to Pike, and we know that it's horrific and tragic. And I don't know to what.
And I thought that was handled really well.
Yeah, I thought so too. Yeah. Yeah, I know. I mean, yeah, I mean, that was really, would be beautifully handled, in fact. I mean, a lot of this, Anson Mount is just peerless in that role.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just almost born for it, really. So,
but adds just so much more to the tragedy of the character, knowing that he knows what his fate is.
And the good thing is that if you sit and rewatch The Menagerie, you can feel that.
Yeah.
You can now feel that, so it takes on greater meaning. I mean, there's tremendous value in that second season of Discovery.
Listeners, if you haven't heard our Menagerie discussion, please do, because me revisiting that was really just brought.
Yeah, it was a real pleasure. It was a real pleasure, as it has been a pleasure talking about Captain Kirk and James Kirk in this episode of Whom Pods Destroy. Is there anything burning that you wanted to say about the character now that you? No,
I think that we've covered that. You know, I mean, I'm sure we could spend hours doing this.
I'm sure our listeners would probably think, "What about?"
But so, the nature of our podcast, we'll probably come back to Kirk.
We will come back. It is a Star Trek podcast.
I'm sure he'll be in the next episode.
I don't know. I don't know what the next episode is going to be about, but we're going to start counting down to our celebrations of the 40th anniversary, rather, of Star Trek the Motion Picture, relatively soon. So look out for that, listeners. Really. It's a good film.
It is a good film. I'd be watching it again, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good film. I was talking to someone in the pub yesterday who said, on my recommendation, revisited the Star Trek movies, and he said he was surprised about how much he enjoyed Motion Picture, because he remembered when he first saw it, he thought it was a bit dull.
Yeah, I'd be surprised. I'd be interested to find out from people who got into Star Trek through the Next Gen.
yeah,
and see what they think of
motion picture
as this sort of proto next gen.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we'll go into that in depth. We're also going to talk about the Changeling as well, because that's part of the whole motion picture thing, because basically they use the same script, and also Phase Two, which we'll be having a conversation about as well, which is quite a big.
So basically, we're going to have a lot of fun. Hopefully, the listeners are going to have a lot of fun listening to us having a lot of fun.
But hopefully, you'll enjoy our opinions. And if you disagree or want to echo our opinions, then you can get in touch with us. We're on Twitter. GreenPods Destroy is the Twitter handle, and if you want to, you can email us if you want to, garth@whompodsdestroy.com, although I don't believe we've ever received an email, so I mean, be the first listener.
Yeah, Garth is just sitting there waiting.
He's just going, you know, he's like, I am Lord Garth, you know. please do contact Lord Garth, and that's it really. I think we'll leave it there until next time. Yes. So thanks very much, guys.
And it's a lovely day, and we're going to go to the
Some football.
Yeah.
We're going to go to the pub and watch some football.
Yes.
Fantastic. Okay, well, until the next episode of Impulse Destroy, from myself, Terry, and from Derek and from Graham, it's goodbye.
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 Second start of the riot. And straight on till morning.